During this week, we've been exploring the various aspects of the Eightfold Path. And we skipped the middle section during the middle of the week, the section on ethics, wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood. We thought that in the midst of a silent retreat where we're doing more of the inner work, that it would be more appropriate to bring that, this aspect of our Eightfold Path into going home. And so we'll be all leaving here tomorrow. And this aspect of the Eightfold Path really does speak about relationship. How do we relate to the world, our fellow human beings? So our meditation practice includes not only an exploration of what's happening inside of our hearts and minds, but also an exploration of how we are in relationship. And this is very clearly brought right into the Eightfold Path. I think it's a beautiful thing that the Buddha's understanding of freedom is not just about looking inward, but is also about the field of connectivity and friendship, relationship, non-harming. And the work that we do in this aspect of the Eightfold Path, the work in creating skillful relationship, it's not just about working in the field of our outer relationships. It also has an impact on our minds. Essentially, that the practice of cultivating skillful relationships helps us to cultivate a more peaceful mind through this practice of non-harming. So the ethics section of the Eightfold Path comprises wise speech, which has four aspects. And all of these aspects of the Eightfold Path are, and they're generally framed in terms of things to avoid. So with wise speech, we avoid false speech, harsh speech, divisive speech, and idle chatter. And wise action incorporates refraining from killing living beings, refraining from taking what's not given, refraining from harming with our sexuality. And then wise livelihood. I think the easiest way to really explore wise livelihood is to reflect on finding a livelihood in which we can engage in wise speech and wise action. There were some specific things the Buddha said. We should refrain from having livelihood, he said, that involves trading in poisons, weapons, human beings, things like that. But essentially, it really is about finding a livelihood in which we can engage ethically. So rather than trying to give a talk tonight in which I try to cover all of that, I thought I'd speak more generally about ethics and its place in our practice, and how for me it actually is a very beautiful part of the path. So I think on the first evening I talked a little bit about the precepts, and if you look at the the wording of these aspects of the Eightfold Path, the first four of the precepts, refraining from killing living beings, refraining from taking what's not given, refraining from harming with sexuality, refraining from false speech, those are all found right in the Eightfold Path. The fifth precept about refraining from intoxicants is not explicitly here in wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood. And yet the understanding around refraining from intoxicants is that essentially what we're trying to do in our practice, what we're trying to cultivate in our practice is a clear mind. And clarity of mind is obscured with intoxicants. And so we can just explore that aspect of the precepts in that way, thinking about how do my actions in the world support clarity of mind. So most generally, ethics in the context of our practice is, well, it's framed in these ways of avoiding actions, and that can have the reminiscence for some of us who were raised in the Judeo-Christian tradition of the commandments, thou shalt not. And we may have our own relationship to that framing of ethics. And for myself, I have appreciated the framing of ethics in the Buddhist tradition as not so much just hard and fast rules to follow, but rather a reflection of very pragmatic considerations that if we want to be happy and want to essentially explore what it means to be free of suffering, if we're interested in exploring the Four Noble Truths, if we're interested in looking at what suffering is, what the cause of suffering is, what freedom from suffering is, then the path leading to the freedom of suffering involves not creating harm, not creating suffering. And so the ethical consideration in our practice, in our path, is kind of like the Buddha saying, you know, do you want to be happy? If you want to be happy, this is a skillful way to behave. So it's not so much about wrong and right, it's about happiness and freedom. So exploring ethics in this way isn't so much about just blindly following these ethical guidelines, to just pick them up like they're some kind of thing we're supposed to carry around, but rather to engage with them in terms of as a training. In fact, the term that's translated as precept, sika padang, means training rule or training guideline. And so we engage with these precepts as trainings. And the exploration of ethics involves an exploration of our hearts and minds. It's not just about picking these rules, guidelines up and blindly following them. It's really about exploring in our hearts and minds what happens if we are inclined to behave in certain ways, to begin to explore our minds. And so this exploration of ethics, it's an exploration of primarily refraining from certain kinds of actions and looking at how does that impact our minds. How does it impact our mind to think about not refraining on those actions? And what does it do to us when we actually do engage in working with these precepts? So this really begins to speak to and point to the interrelationship between our mind and our actions, our minds and our bodies. There's kind of a two-way street between how we behave and what's happening in our minds. We all know this, that for instance, if we're angry, we may tend to speak in an angry fashion. Or if we're happy or peaceful, our behavior tends to follow that pathway. And so we're well familiar with this notion of how our mind is influences our actions. And the bridge there, the quality or the factor of the mind, I guess I'll really say factor, the factor of the mind that's involved in that bridge between our mind and our bodies is the factor of intention. And so it's kind of interesting, I think, to reflect on the fact that the ethics section of the Eightfold Path follows the factor of the Eightfold Path of wise intention. That what we are cultivating in inwardly in practicing the precepts, in following wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood, is we're refining our intention. So one of the interesting things about that bridge between our minds and our bodies, that bridge of intention, it seems as though we can use that understanding that intention precedes action to also the direction of the interrelationship between mind and body goes not only from mind to body, but from body to mind. And this is, I think, a lot of how the precepts work for us. If we're open to exploring our mental world as we're engaging in wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood. Because as we, there's the possibility that if we engage in refraining from harsh speech, for instance, we see perhaps our mind inclining towards speaking harshly and we refrain from that. There's the possibility of having that action kind of begin to, I think of it almost as the action of behaving in a non-harming fashion begins to rebound on our mind and create qualities of peacefulness, of ease in our hearts. It's very interesting to watch this happening. And in fact, with respect to these training guidelines, there's an understanding that the activity of refraining from, for instance, killing, as we refrain from killing, then the beautiful quality of compassion is cultivated. And so the activity of refraining from a certain action rebounds on our minds with this beautiful quality. It's said that refraining from taking what's not given cultivates contentment. Refraining from harsh and divisive speech, cultivating kindness. Refraining from false speech, cultivating truthfulness. So that there's this possibility of inner work beginning to happen, the inner work of these beautiful qualities that so help us move towards happiness, being strengthened as we engage with the factors of wise speech, wise action, and wise livelihood. Now, the way that rebound happens, is that we are willing to look at our minds while we are acting. It's not that kind of rebound of the beautiful qualities on our mind is probably not going to happen so easily if we are simply picking up those as commandments and saying, don't do this, don't do that. But if instead we're engaging in the exploration of how our hearts and minds are as we're acting, we begin to see how these qualities, these beautiful qualities, come to be. I'll give an example from my own exploration of this with the precept of refraining from killing, refraining from taking life. There was a period of time in my house where the ants were quite interested in my kitchen. I was really wanting to not have to kill them, and so I found that they tended to be coming in this little spot by the kitchen sink, and when I found the place where they were coming in, like, they would be all over the kitchen counters, these ants, and so I was cultivating refraining from killing. And so I had a practice of trying to find a way to not kill these ants in my kitchen. And so what I did was I, like, took a sponge with soap on it, and I began to corral the ants, because I discovered they wouldn't cross a line of soap. You know, they'd come up to it and they'd back up. And so, you know, I'd see these ants coming in spread out on my counter, and I would corral them with this ring of soap and slowly make the ring of soap smaller and smaller and smaller. This took a lot of time. I mean, this was, I was, you know, working with this precept, and I began to get impatient, actually, I have to say. And so what I started doing was taking a piece of paper and scooping as many ants up as I could, and then depositing them back by their hole so that I could make the corral smaller more quickly. This is over, you know, many times of doing this, so days, you know, many weeks of exploring this. So, and then one day, I discovered that apparently, at least my kind of anthropomorphic projection on the ants was that this activity of picking the ants up and depositing them back by their hole seemed to create a condition of alarm in the ants. Because as I was doing this, as I put the ants back by their place where they were coming into my kitchen, I saw one ant stand on its back two legs. And it was standing up like this, scanning the environment. I had no idea ants would do anything like this. It struck me as an expression of alarm. And in that moment, I felt compassion for these ants. You know, they became living beings to me. They weren't just something that were in my way. And so that was a kind of a real direct teaching for me. I mean, I'd been exploring this precept of not taking life and, you know, trying to do this as in a way that worked both for me and the ants, I thought. What was unexpected for me was the recognition of compassion and the connection that the activity of refraining from killing brought between me and the ants. And that connection allowed the compassion. So, again, if I had just been following it blindly, not kind of being open to it, there may have been more of the resistance or the sense of you know, this is being a burden to do this, rather than an exploration of what's going on. What's going on in my heart and in my mind? So exploring ethics involves both outer work, taking the action, or mostly refraining from action. It's interesting the way these precepts and these are worded is in terms of refraining from action. And it's an interesting reflection to explore, think about why that is. Why is it that these precepts are worded in this way? Bhikkhu Bodhi had a beautiful reflection on this. Bhikkhu Bodhi is one of the main translators of the Pali texts that we use to understand what the Buddha taught. And his reflection on the negative framing of the precepts, because, you know, we like things phrased in the positive, you know. Maybe especially here in California, you know, we want to have our guidelines being, you know, we're going to cultivate love and compassion, and you know that we're going to, you know, that's what we're vowing to do. I vow to cultivate compassion and contentment. And but what Bhikkhu Bodhi said is, well, a couple things. He said that that we can't actually take the action to cultivate those inner qualities while doing actions that are in opposition to them. And so the Buddha is pointing to these as, if you engage in taking life, engage in taking things that are not given, you are acting in opposition to the qualities, the very qualities that are leading you towards happiness. So that's one piece, that we can't really do the work of cultivating the wholesome qualities of mind while we're engaged in activities that run counter to them. And then the other piece that he pointed to, which I think is really helpful for us to reflect on, he said that we can actually have some hope of vowing, of saying, I am going to refrain from taking this action. I'm going to refrain from taking life. That we can have some hope of actually following through on that. But if we take a vow to be compassionate, what he said is something, the framing of what he said is something along the lines of, our inner state of mind, our inner qualities, are just not so, simply so docile as to be guided by command of will. You know, we can't take a vow to say, I will be loving and kind. You've been watching your minds for the last week. The habits of mind are very strong. And so, as Bhikkhu Bodhi put it, to take such a vow is actually to put ourselves in a double bind. And so we can stand towards taking the committing ourselves to the precepts of refraining from certain actions. And then he says, and then we can do the inner work of cultivating and nurturing those beautiful qualities. And some of that work of cultivating and nurturing those beautiful qualities is the very refraining from those actions. Again, that kind of inner-outer rebound. So another aspect of the ethics that is a beautiful reflection, I think. There's a place in the texts where the Buddha talks about what a person who's enlightened is like. He says, that person possesses the Eightfold Path. That person, my reading or my understanding of what that means is that that person, a person who has let go of all clinging, naturally is living the Eightfold Path. It's not something they have to think about. It's not something they have to try to do. It's not something you have to pick up and say, oh yes, I should not do this, I should do this. It's their being is an expression of the Eightfold Path. And so ethics for someone who has let go of craving very naturally expresses itself in this way. That person, it's said that someone who's enlightened can't break the precepts. So in a way, what we're doing here in taking on or cultivating these aspects of the wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood, what we're doing is we're modeling what we are aspiring to become. And essentially, if we have the examples of people who are awake, they are engaging ethically, and if we follow their example, we will behave ethically. So this practice of ethics, in one way of looking at it, the framing of the refraining from taking what's not given, refraining from taking life, refraining from harsh speech, divisive speech, refraining from false speech, refraining from idle chatter, it's protecting others to engage in these factors of the Eightfold Path. So we're protecting others as we engage in ethical conduct. That seems kind of obvious in a way, that we're refraining from causing harm in the world. And yet, we're also protecting ourselves in acting ethically. Because, well, we've seen, I mean, you know, think about what happens in your mind if you lie to somebody. You know, that initial feeling might be, you know, maybe it's a little white lie or something, you know, and actually your outward sense of the intention is that you don't want to hurt that person's feelings. But what happens in your mind, you know, in that little white lie is the mind becomes unsettled. First of all, it knows, the mind knows it hasn't been honest, and also perhaps starts becoming restless. Who else knows this person? That person knows that person, and that person knows that I wasn't doing what I told that person I was doing, so I'd better make sure that that person doesn't talk to that person, or if they do, that they know that they can't say this and that and the other thing. And so our minds get restless in even just a simple thing like a white lie. And so refraining from these kinds of actions also protects our own minds. It protects our minds from this kind of restlessness. It also protects our minds from remorse. You know, saying something harsh to somebody, ooh, how much inner regret that can create. So the precepts and these aspects of the Eightfold Path, the ethical aspect of the Eightfold Path, have, it's said they have two aspects to them. They offer, what's said, the gift of fearlessness to those that are around us, because people in our company don't have anything to fear from us if we're behaving ethically. And it's also said to offer the bliss of blamelessness to ourselves. So this is a place of great joy, actually, that we begin to take delight in our ethical conduct. The other day, Gil was speaking about a set of kind of natural steps towards concentration, and how delight and joy will naturally lead us towards concentration. There's a place in the text where the whole thing begins with ethics. It says that it's very natural that one who's ethical, who behaves ethically, experiences no remorse. One who doesn't experience remorse experiences delight, experiences joy, experiences tranquility. The whole chain that Gil was talking about last night that leads to concentration begins with ethics and the freedom from remorse, the bliss of blamelessness. It's said that to be really helpful to reflect on the delight of your ethical conduct. I think I brought this in the very first evening, or some point I brought in this thought about, you know, it's not a small thing to refrain from killing living beings. I mean, even just killing human beings, you know, not much less the ants and all of the other things that we can refrain from killing, but even just refraining from killing human beings. You know, we don't usually reflect on the fact that I've spent my life and I've never killed a human being. But as I mentioned the other day, you know, imagine how different the world would be if everybody would commit to that. So it's not a small thing to commit to that and to appreciate the word in Pali is sila. For me, that word just lands in a way that feels good, you know. Reflecting on our sila, reflecting on our ethical conduct can bring delight. And sometimes it goes by us, because very much we do engage ethically. In so many ways we engage ethically. And we, of course, remember the ways in which we don't. Now that's helpful to acknowledge and to look at where we don't engage ethically, and I'm going to talk about that in just a moment. But to remember how much there is of ethical conduct in our lives. This can bring joy to us. There's another teaching that the Buddha gave his own son on ethics. It's a beautiful teaching. He gave this teaching to his son when his son was 7 years old. And it's simple enough that a seven-year-old can understand this teaching. And yet when we look at it and, you know, read what the Buddha was saying his son should do, it's like, wow, this is a practice for a lifetime. He basically said that whenever you're getting ready to engage in an action, and so he didn't set down for his son in this particular situation, he didn't say, don't do these things in that way. He said, whenever you're getting ready to engage in an action of your body, an action of your speech, or an action of your mind, look at that and reflect. Use your intellect, reflect. Is this action going to cause affliction? for someone else, for myself, or for both. And so a simple, he pointed his son to a reflection on non-harming in actions of body, speech, and mind. And using reflection, reflect before you act. Is this going to cause harm? And he said, if you see that it is going to cause harm, refrain from doing it. Don't do it. And so that's using a kind of more general principle for ethics to look at, is this action going to cause harm? If it's not, he said, if you do not see that it's going to cause harm, go ahead and do it. But the teaching doesn't stop there. He says, while you're doing an action, look at, is this causing harm? And if it is, stop. If it's not, he said, please continue. Again, looking at what's the impact of our actions. And then the teaching doesn't stop there. He says, after you have done an action, reflect back. Was anyone harmed? Was their affliction created for self, for others, for both? If there was, the instruction is undertake restraint in the future. In elsewhere, in other places, there's a not so much a, it doesn't actually say anywhere make amends, but there is the I think that's a something we should reflect on. If we've seen that our actions have caused harm, that possibility of making amends. So this teaching that the Buddha offers his son, it gives us a kind of a different perspective on ethics in a way. It's a simple guidelines for looking at your actions using reflection, using the power of our minds to know. Our minds can understand the consequences of things before we do it, right? I mean, if we catch in the moment before an action, like, you know, that moment before we do something, we see a gathering of frustration and we see this moment right before we're getting ready to say something harsh to somebody. If we see that before it happens, we know in our minds. Our minds understand that that will cause harm. So if we see it before it happens, we have the opportunity to stop. And it takes perhaps a little more skill to stop in the midst of something. And, you know, something I sometimes say to people, because one of the things that this does, one of the things that this exploration does, is it begins to help us to uncover those blind spots, the places where we're, you know, maybe not so clear. Like that, the story I told the other day about the butterflies, the guy that, the little boy that had the butterfly collection and pried open the chrysalids and the butterflies died. Exploring this, you know, his, without the knowledge of how the butterflies need to exert the effort in order to fly, the action before and during seemed harmless. And so the reflection afterwards is what's really important here. The recognition that action created harm. Now the instruction here isn't beat yourself up and, you know, tell yourself you're a horrible person, but learn, what did I not understand? What did I not know? So this is a real place of beginning to kind of uncover blind spots in our hearts and minds, learning from our mistakes. And exploring what to do when we have caused harm. So we may act, say something. One time a friend told me he said something to someone. It was a kind of a chaotic party of some kind, is my understanding. There was a lot of chaos going on, and my friend walked in and said, "Wow, it's just like Hell's Kitchen." And the person whose kitchen it was got startled and felt hurt by that. And he saw that immediately. And, one of my suggestions to him was, your intention wasn't to cause harm there. But seeing that that harm was created, one of the things that we need to get really good at doing is cleaning up the mess. Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to say something that would make you feel bad, and to acknowledge that you see. Yes, I see that caused harm. I'm sorry. That's the form of making amends, to request forgiveness, essentially. I hope that you can forgive me. I didn't intend to cause harm there. Sometimes one of the things we really need to explore when we do find ourselves in the situation of having hurt someone is to not try to justify things in our minds. I've seen in my own mind sometimes if I've done something, and it's kind of like I'll watch my mind going over and over, but it was really okay. Really that was okay because of this and this, and there were these mitigating circumstances. And it's the mind essentially trying to escape the discomfort of having caused harm. And so that's an edge for us to open to the pain of having caused harm. And that's where a lot of our learning happens. We feel the compassion, the empathy that begins to develop with this practice is that we feel it when someone else is suffering. And we can feel our own resonance with that suffering. And sometimes we shut down around that. And that's our work. Can we stay open to, can we acknowledge and meet the pain of having caused pain? There can be a sadness at having caused harm. That can be pretty pure, actually. What we tend to do there a lot of times is beat ourselves up. We put a guilt trip on ourselves. And that's not so helpful. That's not what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about is an open-hearted recognition of the pain of, it's like this when I've caused someone else suffering. And there can be a kind of a purity to that recognition of, that's what it feels like to have caused someone suffering. And there can be a sense of the sadness of that. Not a constricted sadness, but a sadness that recognizes it and also then wants to not do that in the future. So self-forgiveness is helpful sometimes. If you do find that remorse, that guilt thing going, the forgiveness practice is helpful on two sides, actually. You know, forgiveness practice is often an internal practice, and yet sometimes it can be helpful in healing ourselves to actually ask for forgiveness. You know, I caused harm. I hope that you can forgive me. There's a kind of a healing that happens in that that process. It may be that you understand or know that that person might not be in a place or ready to forgive. And so then the practice can be inward, to almost have an image of the person and express, I ask for your forgiveness inwardly, as a way to make some of that bridge of acknowledging how you've harmed someone and requesting for forgiveness. And then there's the acknowledgement for things that I have done to myself. May I forgive myself. For ways that I've harmed myself, may I forgive myself. Sometimes that's hard to do that. So again, an internal reflection. So actually, this exploration of ethics is a pretty deep place of exploration in the path of freedom. The Buddha pointed to the present moment and the quality of intention. Essentially, you know, intention is, at one level, there's a kind of intention that happens in a moment. The momentary intention to speak or act, that's happening in the present moment. And it's possible, actually, to begin to recognize that intention, that there's just this moment of mental impulse that precedes every action of body, of speech, of mind. And we can begin to see that. The guidelines of ethical conduct help us to begin to see that moment, because we are bringing in, almost as mindfulness bells, refrain from taking life, refrain from taking what's not given, refrain from harming with sexuality. And so taking those on, sometimes we begin to see just the movement of, you know, picking up a shoe to hit a spider. Oh, wait a minute, I'm not going to do that. So we may be able to see the intention to act before the action has followed. And this is a very potent moment. The Buddha really pointed to this moment. He said that, you know, that in the moment of taking action, that intention to act, it's going to be accompanied by wholesome qualities of mind or unwholesome qualities of mind. And when, in a moment, our intention to act is accompanied by greed, aversion, delusion, fear, confusion, anger, he said, that will lead us to suffering. When that intention, that moment of getting ready to act, is accompanied by non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion, that leads us towards happiness. And so the cultivation of ethics in our path, in our practice, begins to help us to see these moments of choice, these moments of getting ready to act. And in the moment of seeing, before we act, we have an opportunity. It's really quite amazing. I mean, just a simple practice around speech, for instance, of seeing if you can pause before you speak. Now, that's not an easy practice, I grant you. It's not an easy practice, and yet it is one we can work with, to see if you can just, in a moment, pause before you speak. In that moment of pausing, you've caught the intention to speak. So there's the urge to speak has been noticed. And in catching that urge, in that moment, you probably will know, before the words have come out of your mouth, you'll probably have some idea of what you're going to say, and maybe something about why you're going to say it. So the moments of refraining from action give us more and more opportunity to begin to see these choice points, to see these moments of action, and begin to look into the motivations that accompany our intentions. Having seen that choice point, there's a remarkable degree of possibility to choose whether we follow through on that intention. And in seeing the qualities that are leading us to suffering, the mind begins to recognize, you know, not that way. Let's not follow through on those actions. Let's see if we can turn towards wholesomeness here. The very first two verses of the Dhammapada kind of capture this teaching. All experience, and this is as close to Gill's translation as I remember. I don't have it in front of me, but all we experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. Speak or act with a corrupted mind, and suffering follows, as the wagon wheel follows the hoof of the ox. All experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. Speak or act with a peaceful mind, and happiness follows like a never departing shadow. Let's just sit for a few moments.